Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the 2020 Camden Conference. The theme of this year's conference is Media Revolution, Changing the World. This is part two of a three-part Speaking in Maine series focusing on the Camden Conference. First, we will hear from Joshua Tucker, professor of politics, Russian and Slavic studies, and data science at New York University. The title of his talk is Social Media, Democracy, Fake News, and Fact-Checking. During the second half of the program, we'll hear from Kathleen Hall Jamison, professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Her talk is titled Cyber War, Coping with the Challenges Posed by Trolls and Hackers. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speakers today is David Brancaccio, the host of Marketplace Morning Report.
Now, to a polymath professor from New York University. I said polymath, I didn't say math professor. New York University's Joshua Tucker is professor of politics, co-director of the Center for Social Media and Politics, and director of the Jordan Center for the Advanced Study of Russia. Why did he get invited? Today he'll explore the crucial interplay among social media, democracy, fake news, and fact-checking. Dr. Tucker.
Thank you, David, for the very kind introduction. Thanks to all of you for being here today. It's a great honor to be invited. And as David said, I'm going to be talking to you about social media and democracy, fake news, and crowdsourcing fact-checking. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of start off and end up with some sort of larger points in thinking about social media and democracy and how we can study social media and democracy. And then I'm going to wrap that around showing you some research from our lab at the Center for Social Media and Politics, focusing on these topics of fake news and fact-checking. So what I want to begin with is a sort of broad-based way of thinking about how social media interacts with democracy, and in particular to ask this question, which is, we started off way, way back, long time ago, right, all the way back in 2011, and social media got this coined by this name, this article appeared in the Journal of Democracy that was called Liberation Technology, right? And then a great deal of time goes by, many, many years, right, all the way up to 2017, 6 years later, and we get to, in the exact same Journal of Democracy, can democracy survive the internet? So the question is, how does social media, even for fast-moving technology, this is whiplash speed, how do we go from thinking about social media as something that's going to usher democracy in throughout the world, right? It's going to be this major challenge to authoritarian regimes, this major force for democratization, to is social media going to undermine democracy itself within 6 years? Did we get it really, really wrong way back in 2012, 2011, when we talked about liberation technology? Or are we overreacting now when we say, can democracy survive the internet? So we wrote a piece along with co-authors, I wrote a piece along with a number of co-authors that also appeared in this Journal of Democracy that's called From Liberation to Turmoil. And in this, what we try to do is explain how social media can be both liberation technology and can democracy survive the internet. And the way we do it is by making two simple assumptions. And that's it. So the first assumption is that social media is a tool that provides voice to people who are excluded from access to mainstream media. So that's the first assumption. Voice to people who don't have access to mainstream media. The second assumption we make is despite the fact that social media democratizes access to information, and I would stand here today and say that that is an indisputable claim, social media has given more access to more people about more things and more information about politics, about news, so it's democratized access to information. But despite the fact that it democratizes access to information, it's still a tool that can be used for censorship. All right, so let me walk you through how these arguments can explain how social media is both liberation technology and can democracy survive the internet. We start with a new hope. Social media as liberation technology. The context here is in authoritarian regimes. If we think about authoritarian regimes, or what political scientists often call competitive authoritarian regimes, and we ask the question, outside of open societies, who is excluded from access to mainstream media? Well, it may be other potential authoritarian actors, but maybe it's nationalists in these countries, maybe it's other people who want to have power. But almost by definition, when you're in an authoritarian regime, you're going to exclude pro-democracy forces, people who want to bring about regime change. You're going to exclude them from access to mainstream media. These are not the people who are going to be showing up on the evening news and in the pages of the newspapers. So in the context of authoritarian regimes, social media becomes a tool that can be used by pro-democracy forces because it allows them to communicate. It allows access to information. As the way we talk about it as social scientists, it can be a tool that's helpful in overcoming collective action problems. It allows people to get organized. It's a vertical communication tool. And it's a way, in particular, when these social media platforms are located in the West and they're outside the control of governments within these countries, it's a way that pro-democracy actors are able to communicate with each other. And that's when we get things like the Arab Spring, or Euromaidan in Ukraine, or Gezi Park in Turkey. And so we have this kind of a new hope liberation technology. This picture in particular, the Who's Afraid of Twitter, is a famous photo that came out of the Gezi Park protests in Turkey. So there's your kind of liberation technology. But of course, nothing really ever happens in a vacuum in politics, right? And what we end up with, of course, when certain actors act in one way, other actors will eventually react. Now, it may be the case that there was a period of time where authoritarian regimes were not understanding of the threat posed by democracy. There are reasons we think that authoritarian regimes may have difficulties understanding new threats, especially if the way the power structure is set up is that you get closer to higher levels of power by being a yes person to the great leader or whoever that happens to be. You don't want to be the one in the room necessarily saying there's this huge new problem out there that we don't see coming. So maybe there was a period of time where regimes were not aware of this. But of course, over time, regimes begin to see that this is a threat. And what happens then is that regimes have to think about how they're going to respond to online opposition. And I would posit, and we've written a piece along with other co-authors from the social media, from the SMAP Lab, we've written a piece in a journal called Comparative Politics, where we laid out a sort of big picture theoretical framework for thinking about the tools that actors had at their disposal, that these authoritarian regimes have at their disposal to respond to online threats. And you can basically think of these as one of three categories. The first is they can respond offline, right? You don't have to respond to an online threat online. You can respond to an online threat offline. That can be things that we would traditionally think about this, such as suppressing dissidents, you know, locking up bloggers, even shooting people, physically harm, threatening the people who are involved in this. It can also involve not just these kind of attacks, particularly at the people that are mounting the online opposition, but it can also involve changing the legal structure, changing requirements for liability, right? Changing these kinds of infrastructure where it's possible to go after online actors in different ways than was possible before, all the way up to the extent of trying to change the ownership of these companies. So if you study Russia, for example, you're familiar with VKontakte, which is a Russian social media outfit. And eventually, the founder of VKontakte had to flee the country and was replaced by a Putin loyalist. So that's one set of options that you have. You can always respond to online opposition offline. But a second set of options you have, and a third set, involve online responses. So the second thing we talk about is online restriction of access to content. This is kind of your traditional censorship. You try to prevent people from seeing the information online that's harmful to your regime. So if you have pro-democracy activists, you try to censor them. Now, the sort of regime par excellence about this is China, who I know you all talked about last year at the Camden Conference, and the sort of great firewall of China. This is the kind of understanding that we have of this kind of ways to deal with restricting online access to content. And there are other countries that engage in this kind of behavior as well. In a sense, though, this is an old story repackaged in a new technology, right? We have years of regimes that try to censor access to information, whether it's by censoring it in print media, censoring it in radio, censoring it in other forms. This can then just be brought to the internet. But it's difficult, and there are lots of different, there's trade-offs between different tools that you can do this, right? You can do this in a very clunky way, where you shut off access to the entire internet, which we've seen, for example, recently in Iran. But that causes all sorts of other collateral damage to your economy. It also ends up making people really angry when you're shutting down things that they want access to. Molly Roberts, who's one of my co-authors on the Liberation and Technology paper, has this fantastic paper where she actually looks at what happened when China restricted access to Instagram. You saw a huge jump in the number of VPNs that were being downloaded in China, at which point people started going and visiting the New York Times website and Google as well. So there's unintended consequences that happen from these sorts of things. But, and perhaps most germane for this discussion, there's a third way that regimes can respond, which is by what we call online engagement, which is trying to change the nature of the online conversation in a more beneficial pro-regime point of conversation. And in some ways, this is a good thing, right? This harkens back to the original promise of e-government, right? The internet was going to bring politicians and bureaucrats closer to the mass public. And so if what you have happening is politicians going online, getting involved in the longer version of this talk, I have a picture of Dmitry Medvedev out in Twitter, you know, putting his first tweet out into the public. In some ways, we think that would be a very positive thing. It breaks down barriers between politicians and the ruled and the masses. But of course, there are all sorts of other more nefarious ways you can try to get involved with changing the nature of the conversation online. And that's where we get the rise of, we get bots. Those of you who are familiar with Soviet icons, you'll recognize the Putin, as this is a takeoff on the famous Brezhnev, you know, sending the tanks out. Now it's Putin sending out the Twitter birds. But you get the rise of bots, these kind of automated accounts that produce content. You can get trolls. You can get propaganda campaigns. You can get the rise of misinformation campaigns. And this is famously, this is the headquarters of the Internet Research Agency in Russia, which unleashed famously the Russian trolls on the 2016 election. So this is kind of the next stage, right? The empire strikes back, you get repression technology. Then we take the context, however, to what does this say about democracies, right? And this is the third piece of it, which is that in the context of democracies, if you ask who's excluded from access to mainstream media and democracies, well, you could take a kind of Chomsky Marxist viewpoint of this, that they're part of the capitalist means of production, and so more progressive voices are going to be excluded from access to mainstream media. And we do see, for example, the rise of things like Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street facilitated by social media. But of course, in democracies, you also have, in general, and until perhaps very recently, you have these kind of anti-systemic, fundamentally, voices that are illiberal, that are against the sort of democratic system of politics. These are also excluded from access to mainstream media, right? You didn't turn on the TV and see white supremacists on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. So the same tools that can help pro-democracy activists overcome collective action problems, these tools can help people like white supremacists or non-democratic actors in democratic systems. They can also use these tools to find each other. If you're the only white supremacist in your entire county, previously when you were limited by geographic proximity to people to organize, it's a lot harder to get organized. Whereas now, if you can go on 8chan or 4chan and find other white supremacists, you can get organized in that format. The key thing here is it's the same affordances of social media that help the democracy activists in liberation technology that help people who may want to undermine democracy in this kind of rise of the anti-systemic forces. But this, again, is not operating in a vacuum. And what you have going on at this point in time now, of course, is that the tools that came out of these authoritarian regimes, bots, trolls, disinformation campaigns, these are tools that can be used by these anti-systemic actors in democracies as well. And in particular, they can be used for amplification, for making voices louder, right? So think about this for a second. How many of you in this room have heard of the Women's March, and how many of you have heard of the march in Charlottesville? How many of you, wasn't meant to be a poll. But the point is, people have heard of these things. How much media attention have you heard to each of these things, right? The Charlottesville March had 300, 400 people in it. The Women's March had 4.5 million people, and it was the largest march in the history of the United States ever. And yet, with these amplification tools, we can get these senses of equivalency. So the big picture thing here is that when we think about social media, this question of from liberation to technology, the argument we make is that social media itself is neither inherently good nor bad for democracy. Social media, and the way to think about it is, it's a set of tools with a set of affordances that political actors who interact with each other and take account of what the other political actors are doing will try to use to compete for power, the same way that political actors always use tools that they have at their disposal. And so if we want to understand the politics of this moment correctly, what we need to do is understand the affordances of these tools. I've shared some of them with you here today. What I want to do now is dive deeper into some of the sort of research that we've been doing in terms of these questions. Now, I will say it is very, very rare experience, and I'm a bit flattered to be the third speaker on a program and have had everyone mention one of your main findings that you presented in your talk before you even get to present it in your talk. So I'm going to walk you through, what we did here. So as you know, 2016, if you were watching the 2016 election in the United States, it would be pretty impossible to have heard a discussion of that in the aftermath without this discussion of fake news. Now, I share Nico and some of the points that have been raised before about using this term, fake news. In this particular study, we're actually going to use this to refer to sort of fake newspapers, things that were pretending to be real newspapers that were not newspapers. But you would have seen all sorts of things like this had you been paying attention, that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump, or that Hillary Clinton, it had been confirmed that she did in fact sell weapons to ISIS and other things along these lines. You will also have seen things, and I thank Nick for having shown way more detail on this, so I can go through this slide quickly, but about how people are consuming much more news from online sources, how that's particularly true among the young, but is increasing among all aspects of the population. So the question remained, though, after the election, we got a lot of information about fake news. And when I think about fake news or misinformation or disinformation, right, these deliberate attempts to spread incorrect information, I always think there are four big questions we want to understand. One is who produced this, the second is who shared it, the third is who's exposed to it, and the fourth is what's the impact of being exposed to it. In the aftermath of 2016, there was very good work done by journalists in particular on that first question, who was producing this fake news? We got these reports about Macedonian teenagers and profit motives and stuff like that. Although, of course, now 3 years later, we're getting revisionist questions about who was actually paying the Macedonian teenagers, so that will continue to be a question for a while. What we realized in our lab is that in the aftermath of the election, we actually had the ability to go back and look at who had shared fake news on Facebook, which was not anything that we were getting any information about. And as the previous speakers have noted, what was being talked about is there are all these millennials who get all their news online, there's all this fake news, ergo it must be the millennials' fault that all this fake news is all over the place. But we realized we could figure this out. And how could we figure this out? Well, what we were able to do was we had a panel survey that was in the field over the course of the 2016 elections. That means we were surveying people at multiple points in time. We had invited people in that survey to share their Facebook data with us for the purpose of academic research. I'll come back to this at the very end of the talk, but I want to be assured we did not sell that data to any political consultants. We didn't do anything with that data. We got multiple permissions from people to use this data. But what we realized was that we had objectively the data people had actually post on Facebook on their timelines. And we also had surveys of these people. So we were working with YouGov. We had surveys of the people, and these people had shared their Facebook data with us. So we knew some of the problems with working with Facebook data is you don't often know the characteristics of the people on of working with social media data. You may not know the demographic characteristics of the people who are posting these things, and you have to do a lot of estimation to try to figure this out. When you work with survey data and you ask people, you have to recall to their recall, did you see this fake news story or not? Did you share this? And so we actually had both of these things. We had their demographic characteristics from the survey, and we knew what they had posted on Facebook because they had shared it with us. So we were able to go in and look at these relationships. This is the first graph I want to tell you. And one of the, I don't know how many of the other speakers are going to be showing figures today, but one of the things this follows very much after kind of what Nick just did before, when you get into data about online media consumption, about social media, you are going to see these kinds of distributions, which are called power laws, an awful lot, which means a lot of the behaviors we talk about, and in particular, a lot of the nefarious behaviors about which we're concerned, These are behaviors in which lots and lots of people have no engagement in it, and small numbers of people have a lot of engagement in it. And this has very strong consequences for how we think about policy interventions, which we can talk more about in the Q&A and may talk about at the end here. What we found, and the first thing is, which is quite encouraging, is that we found the vast majority of people didn't share any fake news stories on Facebook over the course of the election. In fact, this is over 90% of the people in our sample were in this far column. What we did find was there were small numbers of people who did this quite a lot. But we started with, so 91% of our sample doesn't share any fake news on Facebook. Now, we used a restrictive definition of Facebook. We were as of fake news. We were as conservative as we could. We took the list that was put out on BuzzFeed by Craig Silverman. We replicated our key findings with lots of other sources here. So, you know, this may be a conservative number. These are the fakiest of the fake news kind of websites. But again, we found this power law of behavior. The second thing we found was that it was not liberals or moderates who were sharing the fake news. But before anyone, I would go too far with this, this is very much an issue that can be considered as a supply side issue. To the extent that based on all academic studies, the vast, vast majority of the studies that we have seen have shown, all the academic studies we've seen, the vast majority of fake news in the 2016 US election had a pro-Trump slant to it. There was not an awful lot of pro-Clinton fake news that was out there. So this may very much be, and I'm going to show you in a second something that coincides with this, driven by supply in terms of the fake news that was out there was more pleasing to conservatives than it was to liberals. But it is important to know this, that when we look at who was doing the sharing of fake news in our study, this is what we found. It's also important because for the next slide I'm going to show you, we can also find the effect controlling for this. This is usually the kicker point of the talk. At this point, you've heard it three times already. But now you've seen the original, right? Not just the second. So you know, you got to do the greatest hits. So basically, this was the big surprise that we got when we were doing this study. What we found was that over 65s, on average, in our study, shared 7 times as many links to the fake news websites as the millennials did. We also found what academics call this is a monotonically increasing relationship. As you got older, you were on average more likely to have shared the fake news. Now, to be clear, this chart does not necessarily mean that most of the fake news that's out there is being shared by old people, because there are fewer over 65s who are online than people who are younger. But it does mean, as David said in the introduction, it does mean that if you walk out of 2016 and you think about policy interventions, and they're all focused on teaching digital literacy to high school students, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with teaching digital literacy to high school students. I'm hugely in favor of that. But this is not necessarily where you need to be teaching digital literacy if you think digital literacy is what's at the heart of that. And that then raises a whole set of really interesting research questions, which is, why is it age? Right, the Occam's razor explanation here is that it's digital literacy. People my age tell their parents to go on Facebook to see pictures of their grandchildren. They go on Facebook, they see something, especially in the 2016 election, there's a picture, a headline, and a blurb from the New York Times, and then next to it is a picture, a headline, and a blurb from the Denver Guardian, which looks exactly the same, saying that the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump, or saying something horrible about Pizzagate, and that they feel really bad about this, and they want to make sure their friends know about this, but of course the Denver Guardian doesn't exist. It's not actually a newspaper, right? It's just been made up. That's the Occam's razor explanation. And I think this is the next frontier of research. We have to figure this out, because if you want to understand what's going on in this disinformation sphere, one of the most important things is knowing whether people are going to be less likely to share fake news if they know that it's false. Now, it may also be the case that people are sharing this information not because they think it's true, but because it agrees with their political persuasions. And if that's the case, then to get the results we do, you need an explanation about why people over 65 might be more interested in sharing their political persuasions and broadcasting them broadly to their friends and family network. We could come up with some explanations for why that might be the case. Some might be economic. You're out of the job market. You're not worried about what other people are going to think. Some might be just increased certainty in the validity of your political views as you get older. We know from decades of study of political partisanship, partisanship is stronger among older citizens than it is among younger citizens. So there's a lot of remaining questions out here, and this is kind of the frontier of this next research. All right, So the next thing I want to tell you about is a brand new study we're doing at the Center for Social Media and Politics on trying to figure out who can actually identify whether or not news is fake. So it follows from this. Or better yet, this is more going back to Nico's category of the junk news. So we're going to combine in this study false and misleading categories. And so this is the big research project that we're invested in. Everything I'm going to show you here is kind of preliminary, still rolling right off the presses. This is hot off the presses research, but I wanted to share it with you today. All right, so what are we doing here? In this study, what we've done, which is quite unlike any other study that's been done in terms of identifying false or misleading news before, is we set up a system where we are looking at articles that appear in the first 24 hours of their publication. And what we did was we set up 5 different news streams, 2 from mainstream news sources, one with articles on the left, one with more mainstream news sources on the right, and then 3 from these kind of junk or suspect or false news or whatever you want to call them news sources. One, a stream of left-leaning junk news, one, a stream of right-leaning false news, and one, a stream of we couldn't even tell when we went and looked at it. It was all over the place, and some of this stuff was just nuts. So we have those 5 streams every day, okay? And they come into our lab. And then what we did, and we did this 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, for 8 weeks, we picked an article that had appeared in the last 24 hours, and we then did 2 things with it. One, we sent it out to a random sample of Americans, where each story was coded by 90 different Americans. And at the same time, we hired 6 professional fact checkers to code every single one of these stories as well. So we're going to use, for the basis of this study, the fact checkers, what the modal response from the fact checkers are, and I'm happy to talk more about this in Q&A. What the modal response from the fact checkers is our ground truth. And we can now look at how our ordinary Americans are doing in identifying false and misleading news. So the first takeaway is, people aren't really good at this. They're pretty good at identifying true news. Right? About true, when the story itself was ranked true by our fact checkers, about 70% of our individuals can figure this out. When it's ranked false or misleading by our fact checkers, only 30% of our respondents are able to correctly identify that. Moreover, the source matters. People are much worse at the false and misleading news from the fake news sources than they are at getting the true news from the fake sources than they are at getting the true news from the mainstream sources. So they're even worse at identifying true news when it comes from these junk sources, which we can think of as good or bad. Interestingly, following on the previous study, age doesn't really seem to matter on this. So for the over 65s in the crowd, you're doing much better on this. Education doesn't really matter nearly as much as we thought it would, although people with only a high school education perform worse on the task, but it's not a strong relationship. Knowing things about politics and the internet kind of help. People who are more politically knowledgeable are more likely to match our fact checkers, and people who are more digitally literate are more likely to match our fact checkers. But what really, really matters is partisanship. As you go left to right here, you're becoming more conservatives. Conservatives are terrible at identifying false news that's conservative, and liberals are equally bad at identifying false news that has a liberal slant to it. So this is a major takeaway and a major point of concern here. If you go out and search, if you encourage people, David, your New Year's resolution, if you go out and encourage people to actually search for information on the internet, I know it's only February, I don't want to dash this for you yet. So I'll give you the good news first. People who go out and search on the internet, we ran some experiments alongside of this, and in one of them we encouraged people to go search for information. They did slightly better at identifying true news. So people who went out there were slightly more likely to match our fact checkers when it was true. Unfortunately, they also were slightly more likely to think false news was true when they went out and looked on the internet for information about it. So this confirms what social psychologists have called a truth bias, that people are inclined to think things are true as opposed to false. So this is also very kind of depressing information. Why do we care? Well, first thing, believing false news makes you more likely to want to share an article, right? We asked people, would you share this online? If people thought the story was true, 60% of them were willing to share it. If they thought it was false, much closer to 20%, which is also kind of depressing if you think about it, that 20% of our sample was willing to share things they had just said were false. But more importantly, this is also important because the platforms are thinking about crowdsourcing. Facebook came out with this about a month ago. Twitter, there was a story yesterday about trying to use ordinary citizens as part-time fact checkers. So we can also use our data to figure out whether or not you can crowd check news in real time. And again, what we do here on the x-axis, we took, remember, we had 90 people who looked at each of these articles, so we started sampling crowds. We're like, we did sampled three-person crowds 10,000 times, and we sampled four, then five, then six. What we find is that with the crowds, crowds are also pretty good at getting right true news. Crowds are not very good at all at getting right false news. You can't just solve this necessarily with the fake news by going, with the false and misleading news by going to the crowds. Moreover, source still matters. Crowds are much better with mainstream news sources than they are with these junk and false news sources. And bipartisan crowds are not better. That was our first thought. We're going to do a lot more with that. In closing, we are living in a world, and you're going to get more and more of this over this weekend, where what's happening online is increasingly important for all aspects of life, where policymakers have to make decisions about what policy should be in this regard. And it's only through independent outside analysis of this data that we're going to know enough of what's happening to be able to make informed policy choices in the future. And so I'll close with that and thank you very much for your time today and look forward to answering questions.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. You just heard from Joshua Tucker speaking about how social media both supports and undermines democracy. Next, you'll hear from Kathleen Hall Jamison, who will be introduced by David Brancaccio.
Kathleen Hall Jamison is a foremost expert on the nexus between communication and politics in America. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication and director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. She knows all about the role of media in political campaigns, and her recent work uses a carefully argued evidence-based analysis to look at the role of the Russians in the 2016 election. She will also have probably, she's the person with the most insight into Russian meddling in the latest one. Her latest book, which she will be doing a signing during the break this morning, is called Cyber War: How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. Paperback edition is coming out soon. If you don't get one here, let us welcome Kathleen Hall Jamison.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you. Good morning. When I was a graduate student, we studied a speech, I believe it was by Wendell Phillips, called The Murder of Lovejoy, a masterpiece of eloquence. And it's existence in that graduate class in the 1960s and early 70s is a testament to the power of rhetoric to conserve narratives that tell stories that matter. And embedded in those stories are facts, but the power of the remembrance is not in the facts. The power of the remembrance is in the narrative. One of the things that we need to find ways to do is to conserve the narratives that encapsulize our facts into structures that we carry with us so that when we are confronted with a need to marshal that narrative, it is there and ready to impel our action. I walked into the National Press Club a long time ago, as we often do because many conferences are held there in Washington, D.C. I went to the top floor in the elevator, and there was the usual desk to pick up your credentials, and there was a journalist sitting behind the desk who said, "Here, you want one of these," and handed me a button. The button said, "Free Jason." I knew nothing about Jason, and I didn't know why we wanted him to be free. I did not know whether this was some kind of an appeal to rescue an animal. I did not know. Think of all the ways in which you say free something. Along with that, there was a description of the cause. I put the button on. I did not know who Jason was before. I knew when I put the button on that I was carrying a narrative. My students were with me, put the button on. They live in a digital world more so than I do. They already were able to find a hashtag #FreeJason. So they started to be able to communicate using it in digital space. But I was still walking around in a world in which I could say I identify with this as a cause, and because of the piece of paper, I now saw the world differently as I read the Washington Post and learned more about his story. So I picked up factual information in the process of carrying the button. The button was the entree into me to a narrative. And as a result, I assimilated data differently because I had a structure that let me see those things as facts, as being important in a different way. And I knew how to structure them. And underlying that was the Washington Post's frame. The Washington Post's frame said, he is being jailed for the crime of journalism. And so we have one frame. He's being jailed because he's a spy. The crime is he's a spy. We have the other frame, which is he's guilty of the crime of journalism. By carrying the frame, he's guilty of the crime of journalism, I could recall the narrative. And I could set in place the facts that I'd picked up from the Washington Post's ongoing campaign. I could talk to others about it in the context of other journalists who had experienced comparable kinds of oppression at the hands of regimes that did not believe that journalism ought to be free or that Jason ought to be free. And in that context, I now could build an awareness of all sorts of other names whose narratives I had. One of the things that is important as we talk about fact-checking is that we don't get lost in the trying to say that's true or that's false, that's misleading or that's not, and we stay in a structure of understanding of why the fact matters. How the fact fits a frame, how the frame fits a principle, how the principle fits a narrative, and how the narrative tells us how we need to act and live our lives. To the extent that when I founded factcheck.org with Brooks Jackson, I called it factcheck.org, I think I did a profound disservice. Because it made it sound as if we care about fact. We don't care about fact, well, we do, but we don't care about the fact in the way in which the name would suggest, because it suggests that's an end in itself. What the fact-checking function in journalism is about is context setting. It is setting facts into structures that create understandings, that build out narratives that help us parse our world into which we can integrate new and different kinds of facts. And to the extent that we get into narrow, small enclaves in which people control those narratives, those frames, and hence those facts, we can't assimilate the facts in the other world, because all they're doing is putting facts in against a narrative structure that can't hold them. So we need to find a way to build the narratives and create the coherence and also create the kind of axes of understanding as a result that are important. And we need to wear our digestive message. For me, Free Jason is a digestive message. We also need to care about what we call what it is we're worried about. I really worry about people using the concept fake news. I worry about it a lot. The biggest success of a person who has managed to traffic that into the national narrative has been getting journalists to use the label fake news. When a journalist uses the phrase fake news, the journalist indicts his or her own enterprise. There is no such thing as fake news. If it's fake, it is not news. News is self-correcting by definition. So let's not say that something is fake news, thereby taking some of the meaning of news that we ought to cherish and stripping away the bark off of it so that it no longer is what it needs to be. We need an alternative vocabulary. I would call what Josh studies imposter news. He's studying sites that pretend they are news sites. They take the banner that looks like news. They take names that sound like news. They take typesets that look like news. They format to say they look like news. And they trick people into thinking they're news. They're imposter news. They're not fake news. The noun for me is imposter. And then I'd put news in quotation marks because they're not news. Imposter is the controlling noun. I want another noun, however, and I want another noun combination for the thing that I worry about in the digital age. I worry when this kind of content that is deceptive goes viral outside the capacity of journalists to screen it, to hold people accountable for it, outside the capacity of opposing candidates and those opposing ideas to take it and grapple with it and knock it down. I worry as a result about its virality and about our capacity inside our enclaves to spread it uncritically, not knowing perhaps that we have been deceived. I want to call that viral deception VD, venereal disease. take the concept of venereal disease for just a moment. How many of you would like it? If you got it, how many of you would want to share it? If you saw it, what would you want to do with it? Cure it, quarantine it. I want to take the negative affect attached to VD, call this viral deception VD, and say, when we see it, we don't share it. When we see it, we try to kill it. And if we're going to kill it, we're going to need those frames and those narratives that will wrap it into a larger explanatory context that will let us knock it down decisively. We did a meta-analysis of disinformation and misinformation and how it can and cannot be corrected. I published it with Dolores Alparacin. It digests to one soundbite for me. Don't refute misinformation and disinformation. Displace it. Put in place an alternative context of understanding that is complex and deep, and as a result, lets people anchor within it and then see facts through it. And that's the reason for saying we need narratives and frames and structures into which we set this misinformation so that it is not just dispatched in the moment. The danger always is, as you try to refute it, you inadvertently reinforce it, but rather you create a frame of understanding that says, when it comes trafficking into your website, wait a minute, you don't get into my world. My narrative here doesn't let you in. My narrative is anchored in discernible reality. With that as a preference, my task is understanding what the Russians did in the 2016 election. I'm going to focus intensely on only one part of an argument. And I'm going to do it because when I looked at this conference, the first thing I said was, this is democratic engagement in action. This is a community that has managed across time to sustain high-level intellectual inquiry on topics that matter not necessarily to the nation and the globe, but to do so in an environment in which virtually every place you turn in this community, someone is helping make this possible. So someone said yesterday, are you going to have any kind of a positive message? Here's my positive message. Thank you, Camden, for putting this conference together. And that means the people who are running the best technical operation I have seen in the whole time I've been doing this, and I'm an elderly woman. And the wonderful people who made something special because someone on my staff checked lactose intolerant. And Pete, who is standing by waiting to play Donald Trump in the event that my video doesn't play and I have to call on him to stand in for Donald Trump. So do we have positive news? Yes, here's my digest. If my digest for protect press freedom is free Jason and keep him free, my digest for democratic engagement, and I have a positive message, is Camden Conference. There are many people here who have focused on the various ways in which journalism has changed and information dissemination has changed. And all of that research is incredibly important and very important as one is trying to understand this changed media environment. But one of the findings that has always intrigued me as we watch people parsing out this world is one that was featured briefly yesterday. And that is, increasingly, we're looking to sources that we can trust. We have to. Because we can't be experts across the board in everything, and as a result, we're tending to go back into an older gatekeeping model. That places real burdens on those who are still trying to protect traditional journalism. And I'm coming here with a constructive, respectful critique of the way in which it behaved in 2016. I want to start out by saying it was a tough situation to be a journalist in 2016 and have hacked content dropped in your newsroom. There's a wonderful report by the Associated Press that tried to give you a sense of what it was like to have thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of information simply dropped in a newsroom. And that AP piece talked about all the resources that had to be deployed toward it. When you deploy toward it, you're deploying away from other things that could have been covered. So the first Russian effect isn't what we saw inside the media streams that we were following. It was all the stories that didn't get written because they were trying to make sure that they had domesticated this source of information that simply flooded newsrooms. The second effect of this disinformation was the effect it had on the Clinton campaign personnel. And as we look forward to future elections, my theme is going to be journalists. We have a special role here. But what happened inside the Clinton campaign was the private exchanges of individuals
were put in public. How many of you would like to see the last, say, 5 years of your email stream simply dumped into public view? And in the process, journalists' contacts with the campaign were disclosed as well, opening journalists to other forms of critique. So suddenly, communications that were assumed to be private were made public in an environment in which they were being selectively manipulated by being deployed strategically throughout the campaign, and the journalists had to decide what is and is not newsworthy. And I'm not here to say don't ever use hacked content, because much of what we get that holds governments accountable comes to us through those kinds of channels. They don't necessarily come to us through channels which have cleanest of hands. And nonetheless, you get accountability about things such as treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo out of material that was gotten by being leaked, for example. Now, granted, hacking puts you in a different category legally. Set that aside for a moment. I want to say I understand that journalists don't start from the presumption that they shouldn't cover it. They start from the presumption they should. And I will argue, yes, they should. But they need to do it in a way that is mindful of the challenges that are being posed, first by the amount of it, and secondly, by the fact that it may not be coming to them in the same way that some of the other things come to them. Think the Pentagon Papers. Suppose you thought that the Pentagon Papers might have been selectively released and only some things disclosed. Suppose that you thought that there was some possibility that it might be forged material. Would you not now treat the Pentagon Papers differently? Well, historically, in retrospect, that document dump stands up extraordinarily well and had high levels of very responsible accountability attached. But you don't know when something comes from a hacked source through Julian Assange and WikiLeaks to the public that they haven't altered the information someplace in the stream. And so now there's an additional challenge for the journalists. So I want to start by saying it's tough for journalists to be there, and I grant that. And in a campaign environment in which now there are not one or two major competitors, but a whole world in which someone is going to put it up there and write about it if you don't, there also are competitive pressures. And I'm going to argue that what the traditional legacy mainstream needs to do is not to satisfy in the face of those pressures, but to maintain its standards of accountability, its standards of what constitutes good journalism, because it still has enough weight in our collective ecosphere that if it is handled responsibly there, that is something of a ballast against all of those other uses. It doesn't mean they're not going to be there. It doesn't mean they're not going to have effect. But you can, if you can trust that journalistic enterprise, the people who are trying to advocate for facticity and being in touch with discernible reality and accountability and good accountability standards can point to it and trust it. And the problem I have in 2016 is in some cases you couldn't do that with the mainstream journalism. And I'm going to argue that mainstream journalism's treatment of hacked content actually may have created an electoral effect, which is the last thing that a journalist is trying to do. By the way, just parenthetically, I want to take exception to the notion that fact-checkers are liberal. As mentioned briefly yesterday, I run factcheck.org. I founded it with Brooks Jackson. Yes, I am self-interested. There are fact-checkers who vote a liberal ballot. There are fact-checkers who support liberal candidates. But fact-checkers are journalists. And a good journalist has norms in place that overcome human biases, that increase the likelihood that those biases are not at play. And if you can say about fact-checking it is liberal or conservative, that is, it has an ideological bent to it, then those norms and that role have failed us. And I can explain in Q&A, if you would like, what we do at FactCheck to try to protect against our human biases. But journalism does it in general. And so I worry when people assume that fact-checking is liberal, because just because you find more things that are factually suspect on one side doesn't mean that you're a liberal. It could be that you've screened out all the things on your side. It also could mean that that side has more facticity problems. Analysis. The first thing the press failed to do was to source the WikiLeaked, in quotes, content to the Russians or to Julian Assange. It largely became WikiLeaks, not Julian Assange or the Russians. After October 7, 2016, we knew the Russians had done the hacking. The journalism reports should have said Russian hacked or Russian illegally gotten, and should have pointed out that Julian Assange was on record opposing the Clinton candidacy. At the point at which the press saw that Assange was strategically timing his material, that is, it wasn't being dropped out sequentially in terms of the chronology in which it actually occurred in real time, they should have put extra barriers up by saying, and Assange appears to be strategically leaking this in order to damage Hillary Clinton. The press largely did not. There are a few exceptions. They simply said WikiLeaks. They did it because WikiLeaks was a trusted source. WikiLeaks had provided content in the past that had been leaked content that had proved reliable. They downplayed or ignored the October 7th confirmation that the Russians were behind the hacking. On October 7th, you have the confirmation by the Department of Homeland Security and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Russians are behind the hacking. You then have the Access Hollywood tape breaking. Then you have same day, same afternoon, you have the first drop of the Podesta emails. The news agenda has now three things on its plate, two of them damaging to Donald Trump. The news media agenda drops the first, the Russian sourcing of the hacking, and basically plays the Podesta tapes against the Access Hollywood tape. In the process, they lost the sourcing. Key premise of journalism, you tell us where you got it. You tell us that you've independently confirmed it, or you tell us you haven't been able to, so we know how much certainty you have about it. Third problem, they failed to note the lack of independent verification. Largely, the materials were unquestioned by the Clinton campaign. At a certain point, reporters, I think, legitimately assumed if there was something to be contested, the Clinton campaign would have contested it. I would argue, nonetheless, all the way through the campaign, because they hadn't independently verified, they owed the public saying, this is Russian stolen content released through Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. I realize this is long, but journalists know how to write in concise fashion, so they can do this much better than I. And also to indicate we have not been able to independently verify the authenticity. Hacked content was not subject to tests of newsworthiness. I invite you to go back and look at the hacked content that got the headlines I'm going to feature in a moment and ask how much of that now sustains the test of newsworthiness. And I know part of what's happening is what's hidden is always presumed to have value. So, for example, when the Clinton speech extracts become public because she has not made them public, faced with recurrent requests by Bernie Sanders, there's the assumption she was hiding something. So there's an assumption, a narrative, that makes it more likely that that's not going to be subject to the test of newsworthy. It's going to be presumed that there is something suspect here, but there still is the test to say, is there? Hacked content altered the media agenda. There are two different ways in which reporters can inadvertently affect electoral outcomes. When you create an imbalance in messaging, so there's a lot of negative messaging about one side and less about the other side, imbalances in messaging shift votes on the margin. When you focus on some narrower range of topics, if those narrow range of topics disadvantage a candidate, you shift votes on the margin. By focusing on the hacked content, they increased the amount of negative material in the news media stream against Hillary Clinton. By focusing on the content of those things that were scandal-tied, and that's in quotes, they increased the likelihood that as you considered Hillary Clinton, you were thinking in terms of those scandals and not in terms of the other things that could have been in the media agenda. The second way in which the news media affects our votes is by telling us what to think about, and that's topical. So to the extent that they focus us on the Clinton emails and what's in them, they are telling us that that's important in our vote consideration as we look at the other matters. And at key moments, reporters took hacked content out of context. Let me take a look at altering the media agenda. These are headlines referring to WikiLeaks. This is WikiLeaks interest, which remained high while Access Hollywood declined. How did the press respond? The overhyped coverage of the hacked emails was the media's worst mistake in 2016, one sure to be repeated if not properly understood. Thank you, David Leonhardt. That's a very important statement. I hope the newsrooms have thought through what they did and asked themselves in retrospect, what would we have done differently, and then projected ahead and said, if we get hacked content, whether about the right, the left, or someplace in between, how are we going to handle it in a way that is as responsible as it could be? I didn't argue that it appeared the emails were stolen by a hostile foreign government that had staged an attack on our electoral system. I didn't push to hold off on publishing them until we could have a less hairy discussion. I didn't raise the possibility that we'd become puppets in Putin's shadowy campaign. I chose the byline. Again, thank you, Amy Jozik, because you're telling me you're aware of it, which means you're telling me you're less likely to have it happen again. How did the press respond? This is the Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the New York Times. Every major publication, including the Times, published multiple stories citing the DNC and Podesta emails posted by WikiLeaks, becoming a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. Notice, it's posted by WikiLeaks. Even this self-aware Pulitzer Prize-winning team doesn't have Assange and doesn't have the Russian stolen content inside its soundbite. Doesn't mean that self-awareness isn't good. It is. Newsrooms need to have thought this through and have articulated and implemented the practices that will mean that they will do better next time. The effects. Hillary Clinton, there's nothing bad that happens to Hillary Clinton after we find out that she was covering up pneumonia and after the deplorables content statement, other than hacked content and performance in debates. So look across everything and say, what's new in all of this? What's new is the stuff that comes through the hacked content. Well, we have baked in the deplorables statement, and we have baked in the fact that she was covering up pneumonia before this survey that I'm reporting is fielded. Across the period in which you have maximum hacked exposure through mainstream as well as conservative media, what you see is perception of who's qualified to be president, the answers to her drop at a statistically significant level. That drop predicts a reduced likelihood to vote. You also see she loses her advantage on shares by values and trustworthiness. The only place that she holds her advantage is on temperament. She's holding it because she's advertising on that theme, and advertising is creating a message imbalance on that theme that favors her. Now, this is an argument by correlation that I can't show causation, but what I can say is, find me something else that's happening during that time that would predict these changes other than that kind of massive exposure. At key moments, they took hacked content out of context. We were warned when we were putting together our slide decks that we shouldn't give you lots of things to read and we shouldn't give you lots of detail. I apologize to the organizers. The reason I want you to read this is I want you to see what WikiLeaks hacked content gotten from a memo by the Democratic staff of Hillary Clinton that was circulating internally to point the top high command of the Clinton staff toward potential statements that could be problematic. I want you to read what the actual hacked content said, because the effect that I'm going to show you is not of the hacked content, it is the hacked content taken out of context. So first, this is what WikiLeaks posts. WikiLeaks, this is Julian Assange, is framing these two things. They're framing the first speech to have said, you need to have a public and private position. They're framing the second as a paid secret speech to bank. My dream is a hemispheric comment market with open trade and open borders. Now, WikiLeaks, and you'll notice I don't think highly of them, has actually left a comma there, which invites you to go down and to say, what's after the comma? WikiLeaks has actually given you some sense that there's some other context surrounding this. But remember, you're really busy. There's a whole lot of material that you're being forced to move through as a reporter. And we've got the presidential debate coming up on Sunday the 9th. This is Friday the 7th. You've got to get your Sunday shows ready. The Sunday shows are going to create a powerful framing effect. And, well, there it is. There's a statement. There's the same. WikiLeaks framed these two statements to be taken out of context. This is what the actual text says. Notice it's a speech to the National Multi-Housing Council. So if you interpret public-private as, I'm talking to the Wall Street banks now and I'm telling them I'm gonna gut Dodd-Frank, well, that's just wrong. You just have to sort of figure out how to, getting back to that word balance, she's extemporaneously speaking, how to balance the public and private efforts that are necessary to be successful politically. And that's just not a comment about today. If you saw the movie Lincoln and how he was maneuvering and working to get the 13th Amendment passed, and he called one of my favorite predecessors, Secretary Seward, who had been the governor and senator from New York, he ran against Lincoln for president, and he told Seward, I need your help to get this done. But if everybody's watching, you know, all the backroom discussions and the deals, you know, then people get a little nervous, to say the least. So you need both a public and private position. That is not about Wall Street banks. That is not about I'm taking any position in public that I'm now privately repudiating. And this is according to the memo that is being accurately capsulized. It's being simply put out by WikiLeaks. Here's the second debate. The hacked content is released the 7th. It's Friday. It's the end of the day. This is Sunday. This is Sunday evening.
This question involves WikiLeaks' release of purported excerpts of Secretary Clinton's paid speeches, which she has refused to release, and one line in particular in which you, Secretary Clinton, purportedly say you need both a public and private position on certain issues. So, two from Virginia asks, is it okay for politicians to be two-faced? Is it acceptable for a politician to have a private stance on issues?
Sources matter. In presidential debates, the moderator stands in for journalism. And the public assumes that when a moderator says that a candidate said something, the moderator is accurately praising that statement. And making the assumption as well that it's not out of context, you can trust the journalist. Martha Raddatz is a fine journalist, but this is a mistake. In this context, the public hears you said this without having the context. And Clinton is now put in the position of saying, but that's not what I was talking about. I was talking about Lincoln, at which point Donald Trump says now she's lying about Lincoln. Second instance. Now I'm going to go to the Sunday talk shows. Remember, Friday the 7th, the Podesta content is released. You've got these hacked speech segments. This is a speech segment memo that is hacked, has been released as part of this, the Russian stolen, illegally gotten material. This is what ABC, now we're doing the Sunday morning news shows, one of the most prestigious venues in journalism. My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders sometime in the future with energy that is as green and sustainable as we can get it, powering growth and opportunity for every person in the hemisphere. That's ABC News. Congratulations, ABC. You put the whole sentence up there. Thank you. There's Face the Nation. Now, I don't think someone said, let's take her out of context. I think someone working really quickly with a whole lot of content took the framing that came through WikiLeaks and had already been picked up in print journalism between that Friday and that Sunday. Here's CNN. In 2013 speech, Clinton told an audience that her dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade, open borders. They have ellipses. Here's Fox. Clinton on trade. My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade, open borders. They've got the ellipses. That happened 14 pages away. She said those two things. They were not proximate to each other. Third debate, October 26th.
In a speech you gave to a Brazilian bank for which you were paid $225,000, we've learned from the WikiLeaks that you said this, and I want to quote, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders." So is that your dream, open borders?
Well, and she basically says, I said more than that. I said, sometime in the future, Western Hemisphere, and then I talked about energy. And her answer sounds disingenuous, and Donald Trump says, there she goes again. The flaw here is in the journalist not honoring a journalistic norm, and it's made harder for the journalist to honor that norm because there is pressure. The early framing was picked up uncritically in the first print pieces and had carried into the Sunday shows. By the time they're preparing for these debates, it is a received wisdom that she actually said it. We had fact-checked the open border statement because Donald Trump continued to say that Hillary Clinton said she supported open borders, and factcheck.org continued to say she isn't saying that in anything that we have that's public. As soon as we got this content, we went and found these speeches, and we said she's not saying it there either. Meantime, candidate Donald Trump tweets out, see, I knew she was doing it all along. Basically, the fact-checkers are wrong. So now we're in a situation in which it is mainstream journalists who are abetting a Russian theft through a leak of an intermediary who's strategically using it to disadvantage one candidate. It's understandable that they did it, but it is problematic that they did it, and we need to figure out how it doesn't happen to another candidate again. Those of you who are Donald Trump supporters, it could have happened to Donald Trump. If you had to look historically at which side you would have guessed the Russians would have intervened in order to oppose, you would have guessed the Russians would have opposed the Republican. We have to be told the sourcing and how it was gotten. We have to know, has the journalist independently verified? And the journalist needs to continue to try to independently verify. And even after the journalist surmises, I believe accurately, about the Clinton hacked content, the Clinton campaign hacked content, the DNC hacked content, that it was accurate, we still need to keep that journalistic norm in place. And we need to ensure that newsworthiness standards are applied consistently across all candidates and campaigns, including hacked content. And we have to make sure that content isn't taken out of context. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speakers were Joshua Tucker, professor of politics, Russian and Slavic studies, and data science at New York University, and Kathleen Hall Jamieson, professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania. They recently spoke at the 2020 Camden Conference, focusing on the 21st century media revolution. Tune in tomorrow afternoon at 2 to hear more talks from the Camden Conference. These talks, as well as all the other talks from this year's Camden Conference, can be found at camdenconference.org. If you missed part of today's program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainpublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.